You're tuned in to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Today on the forum, we have guest speaker John Nichols, who is a spokesperson for Nation Magazine, as well as the co-founder of Free Press. He spoke earlier this year on May 22nd at the Kansas City Public Library. Here he is.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome John Nichols.
I'm delighted to be here in Kansas City, delighted with that wonderful introduction and all the folks I've met tonight and in some cases known for a while from here at the library. I'm also very pleased that my friend and the visionary media activist and media producer Tom Clammer is with us tonight. A well-deserved round of applause. I'm also delighted that the folks from Move to Amend, the grassroots movement seeking to overturn Citizens United, are here this evening. And I do not know them, but I'm rather in love with the oligarchy response team out here. It is... I'm waiting for the moment where, you know, because at this point you're sort of in a kind of forward moving role. I was hoping for the moment when you'll be a cleanup team, cleaning up after oligarchy. In the meantime, I also want to thank all of our friends from the Nation magazine. This is one of the first events of the Nation's 150th anniversary celebration. And yes, The Nation is America's oldest journal of opinion, founded in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, and we are now 150 years into trying to get things right. It is somewhat troubling that we seem to be still writing some of the same editorials that we did in 1865. But it is somewhat encouraging to be in a room like this on a weeknight in Kansas City with people who have come out because they believe that this country can be set right. I am so honored to be with you all here tonight. I want to begin by mentioning an anniversary, not the Nation's anniversary, but the fact, had he lived, Harvey Milk would be 84 years old today. 84 years old. And for I suppose most people in the room know Harvey Milk's story, but those who don't should know that when we got to know Harvey Milk, he was a young man. He certainly looked young. And he was the most out, the most courageous, the most in-your-face gay activist of the 1970s, and Harvey Milk said that the LGBT community did not ask for tolerance. That community asked to be a part of the governance of the nation. He ran for public office. He was elected in San Francisco, and he often said that the reason he was so out, the reason he was so in your face as a gay man was that so he would make the news, that his story would be covered, and kids growing up out in the middle of America would know that even if they were not accepted in their family or in their community, that there were places that would elect lesbians and gays to public office. And today, the United States Postal Service issued a stamp honoring the legacy and the memory of Harvey Milk. So I want none of your, oh, we're not progressing thing. We have our problems as a society, mind you. But the fact that Harvey Milk, who at one time was pushed away from any place of power, was today honored at the White House by the most powerful people in the most powerful country on the planet is a recognition of the fact that sometimes we have to speak up. Sometimes we have to be noisy. Sometimes we have to be the offensive person in the room, the person that people don't like, the person that others say, oh, could you do it a little more quietly? Because sometimes injustice, unfairness, cruelty must be challenged directly. And when we make that challenge, what we find is what Harvey Milk found. And that is that when he went out and said he was organizing for the LGBT community, people in the Asian community in San Francisco said, hey, can we come along too? People in the labor community said, hey, can we come along too, Harvey? Will you go into the gay bars and help them to support our boycott? Of course. People in communities said, you're a good organizer. Let's not do this for one community. Let's build a coalition. Let's free everyone. Let's not just have liberation for one group of people. Let's have liberation with an exclamation mark. Harvey Milk. Ladies and gentlemen, I hate to do this to you because I know some of you have settled in. And when you come to a library setting, and I love being able to speak loudly in a library setting. When you come to a library setting, you think you've settled in and that's the end of your struggle. All you have to do is listen. But this is a participatory moment. And so I'm going to have to ask every one of you to stand up. Stand up. I do this as I travel across the country. I did this up in New Hampshire. I was up there. Townships across New Hampshire were voting on the question of whether to overturn the Citizens United ruling. And I asked everybody to stand up. And there was one guy who was about 98 years old, one of the oldest people I've ever seen at one of my events. And he had a walker, you know, and it was a tough situation. And I said to him, you know, sir, you don't have to stand up. He said, oh, I'm standing up. Right. It took 10 minutes, but he was up with us, and it turned out for a variety of reasons he was the first one to sit down. But that's ladies and gentlemen, this is going to go very quick. It won't be hard. Would all the women please sit down? Not the first time you've been told to sit down by a white guy. Yeah, not necessarily that it went well. Would all the people of color please sit down? People who come from a racial or ethnic background identified in our society as people of color. Would everybody who is a religious dissenter or who has entertained doubts, please sit down? I'm always amazed by how many people that takes out of the room. Would everyone who is not a wealthy property holder, very wealthy property holder, please sit down? It's okay. Okay, this guy's looking for definition here. You gotta let's say a plantation. Are you the president? ladies and gentlemen, I want you to give, let me finish the thought before you do it, but in a moment I want you to give a round of applause because at the founding of the American experiment, he's the guy who would decide every election. The one guy left standing right there. And you're applauding because he's... You may sit down now.
If only.
Well, you what? That's what I'm saying. It's the good thing because you're with us. You're in with us.
I'm with you.
Yeah, well, that's okay because you may sit down. I'm going to let you sit. Now, the reason we do that little experiment at the start, and there are rooms where there's no one left standing. But we usually have one guy. And the reason we do that start is to emphasize that point. At the founding of the American experiment, the founding of this country, women were not allowed to vote. People of color were not allowed to vote. Religious dissenters, even though we have a freedom of religion protection, religious dissenters were not allowed to participate in the politics, often not allowed to sit in public office. The reason Thomas Jefferson corresponded with the Danbury Baptists was because the Danbury Baptists were, in fact, concerned about their place in the politics of the country. They were outliers. They were Baptists. And they were concerned that they were too far from the political and religious mainstream of the country to be participants in the process. The president had to reassure them. But indentured servants, people without property, they could not vote. And so at the founding of the American experiment, when they gathered to elect their members of Congress, when they gathered to elect the people who would govern the whole of the country, every person in the country, whether you were a voter or not, you were governed. When they gathered, they would gather in a room often smaller than this. Small room. And they would be the propertied white males of a congressional district. And the interesting thing was that elections were not always held in November. The November election is a creation of modern times. So is the Tuesday voting. Why we vote on Tuesday? Unimaginable. But the bottom line is that when they had their elections at the founding of the American experiment, it was often held in a room smaller than this, and it was often held in September in a southern state, still often quite warm. And so they would open the windows to let the air in. Sometimes they would even open a door to let the air in. And the women, people of color, landless, unpropertied white men, religious dissenters, would gather outside to look in. Because they were not uneducated people. They were not uninterested people. Many of them were highly engaged folks. They wrote poetry. They wrote novels. They studied. They thought. At night, after they worked 10, 12, 14 hours, they would gather by candlelight to read the Bible, to read the Torah, to read the Quran, to understand what was happening to them, because they were not allowed to be in the room. So they would look in through those windows, and they would often have a hero. They'd often have a champion. They'd say, you know, I like James Madison a little better than James Monroe. There was a congressional race for two future presidents. James Madison and James Monroe ran against one another. And one of the voters was Thomas Jefferson. And so this gives you a sense of how small the group was. And people would look in and they'd say, well, I think that person's a little better. They would actually have sentiments. They would have political ideals. They would care about the results of the race. They just couldn't participate in the process. For them, politics and governance was a spectator sport. It was something that you watched from the outside, that you had an interest in, maybe even that you had a sentiment toward, a favorite, but you didn't get to be a part of deciding what happened. The history of the American experiment, the one history that truly matters, is the history of the struggle to let people in to that room, to make them not spectators, but participants. And it is an epic story that is better than any war story, better than any president's story, better than the story of any oligarch or CEO. It is the story of America, and it has drama, passion, life, and death. We have fought for more than 200 years as a country to open that door up and to say, no, you don't have to look in through the window. You can be a part of this. You can come into this room. You can vote. And it doesn't matter if you are an indentured servant. It doesn't matter if you are a woman. It doesn't matter what you believe about a God or no God at all. You can decide who will govern this country. You can set the agenda of this country. You can frame the issues. Because if you're not in that room, if you're not in that place of power, if you are not framing the agenda, not merely voting, voting's great. One day out of every 4 years, citizenship. But no, you have to be setting the agenda 365 days a year, all the time. You in the American experiment, for it to work, for it to be a functional democracy or democratic republic, you have got to be participating in setting the agenda. Well, here's the interesting thing. If you're not in that room, it's amazing how easy it is not to think about you. It is amazing how easy it is to put your issues off the table. And so the Congress of the United States, for the first 60 years, better part of 60 years of the American experiment, they had one issue that they said, it's too controversial, we won't debate it. Slavery. For 60 years, the Congress of the United States didn't debate slavery. They would sometimes do like a territory compromise or something on expansion. But the actual sin of slavery, the original sin of the American experiment, being founded in acceptance of human bondage, that was not debated. Now, could that possibly have been different if people of color, if African Americans, had been in the room? My sense is yes. Could it have been different for women? Because there were no debates about giving women voting rights or giving women property rights. Might it have been different if women had been in the room? Might it have been different if poor people had been in the room as regards choices about things like distribution of the land? It changes depending on who's in the room. Everything changes depending on who's in the room. And so people died to let people in the room. People died. And this is an important thing to understand because we don't tell the story well. We don't tell the story of our own history well. We like to pretty it up. I started out talking about Harvey Milk. Harvey Milk died with two gunshot wounds in the head, shot by a fellow elected official in San Francisco for the crime of being an activist on behalf of social justice. The number of dead people along this route is many. But the greatest number of deaths occurred in the Civil War. And the Civil War was a voting rights struggle. It's a terribly told story. You know, we now say, oh, the Civil War wasn't really about slavery. Civil War wasn't really about, you know, who participates and who doesn't. The Civil War was a war between the states. It was the North versus the South. Yeah, but what were they fighting about? What was the issue? Why were my ancestors, immigrants from Cornwall, willing to give their life? What was it? Was it that important to keep Mississippi in the United States? I'm going to suggest that to a lot of my relatives, it wasn't the highest priority. They were Wisconsinites. I realize the Mississippians would probably be just happy losing them. But here's the dynamic of it. In mid-1860s, the Civil War didn't go well. It didn't start easily. It wasn't a pretty simple fight. Most of the Southern generals were the leading military leaders in the country. They had been well trained, and they went back to the South. And so the North was ill-led in many battles of the Civil War. It did not have the level of leadership that needed, and it lost a lot of battles. One of the greatest battles was at Lookout Mountain. If you've ever gone down to Chattanooga, you know Lookout Mountain towers over the city, and there, down beyond it is a thing called Missionary Ridge. Missionary Ridge is another high ground just near Lookout Mountain. The Wisconsinites who went and fought in the Civil War, they were arrayed along Missionary Ridge down in that battle of Lookout Mountain. Many of them were Norwegians. They had formed a unit that took their orders in Norwegian. The head of that unit, Hans Christian Hegg, said, "We will take our orders in Norwegian because this is the struggle for which we have been born, the struggle for justice, and we will not let any English speaker tell us to retreat." And these Wisconsinites who were arrayed along Missionary Ridge were not the front line of the military. These were farm boys from rural towns, a lot like some of the Missourians who went and fought in that war, a lot like some of the Kansans who fought in that war. They fought on principle. They fought without much pay and without much respect. They were there because they believed in something. If you read their diaries, you know this to be true. The fight at Lookout Mountain did not go well. General Grant and others tried to take it, but they could not get up that mountain, could not take it. And the challenge there was because this was the line into the Deep South. Everyone knew the importance of this battle. And so over at Lookout Mountain, the Wisconsinites, they weren't there. It was mainly Pennsylvanians, Massachusetts folks. And they stood down. They made the choice that they could not take this hill on this day. General Grant and others were backing down. The word came along the line that this day was not going to be the battle where Northerners, the Union Army, approached that border into the South. And there was a young soldier. He was only in his teens, one of the Wisconsinites, Arthur MacArthur. And he and his unit decided, without an order from above, that they would take Missionary Ridge. And so they gave the order to go over those battlements and to go up that hill. These were 17, 18, 19-year-old kids from rural Wisconsin. The first flag bearer who went over the hill was shot dead immediately. The second flag bearer went over the hill and was decapitated by a Confederate cannonball. The Confederates had cannons above the top there and guns shooting down. You had to go up the hill into that fire. They were shooting the cannons at the folks who were coming over those battlements. So Arthur MacArthur saw these folks on the ground, and he grabbed the flag. And he held it above his head, and he ran up that hill. He took a shot. He took another shot. He was bleeding. He could no longer run. He staggered to the top of the hill, holding that flag. And when he got there, amidst the Confederate battlements, as they came at him with their guns and with their sabers, He waved that flag above there and he yelled, "On Wisconsin." And the Wisconsinites poured over those battlements and began running up the hill. And the Illinoisans came, and the Iowans came, and the Free Missourians came, and the Kansans came. And they ran up that hill into that Confederate cannon fire, into that Confederate gunfire. They died. They were littered across that hill. But they took Missionary Ridge, and in their diaries, when they talked about why they took it, they said, because this war for freedom would not end on their watch. It would not be lost this day. They would enter the Deep South in the cause of human rights, of human freedom, and they would prevail. The interesting thing is that when they finished that war, how many of you saw the movie Lincoln? Okay. What were they fighting about in Lincoln? A constitutional amendment. Because they did not want those deaths to be meaningless. They did not want to have simply fought a war to get the South back in the country. That wasn't the point of that war. It was supposed to be about something. And what it was supposed to be about was ending slavery and giving rights to African Americans. Those constitutional amendments after the Civil War allowed African American men to vote. Do you understand this? Before that war, a man was a slave. After that war, a man was a voter and could be a United States Senator, a member of Congress, a governor. We did not break the barriers to African Americans sitting in Congress in the 1960s or the 1970s. We broke it in the 1860s and the 1870s because they passed constitutional amendments that gave voting rights to African Americans, that gave the right to sit in our Congress, to sit in our Senate. They made real the promise and the suffering of the Civil War. It was a voting rights struggle. And you know what happened? You know what happened when African-American men got the vote? Women started to say, "Hold it. Are you telling me we can pass a constitutional amendment and have a right to vote?" Now, the truth is that women had been organizing before. But the reality that you could do a constitutional amendment and get the right to vote, that you could, with one action of here you go, brother. No, I'm right with you here. All right, just in case. So you're not. I'm not. I'm with you. I'm doing it later. So bottom line is that women said, "Hold it. We ought to be a part of this thing too." And the fascinating thing is that women began to organize specifically, say, "We want a constitutional amendment to give us the right to vote." Now, I was at a great university out east with a wonderful class, the best and the brightest. And I was talking about all these constitutional amendment issues, about changing things. And this young man, he raised his hand up. He said, "Mr. Nichols, you're talking about amending the Constitution to get money out of politics. That's hard. It's not easy like giving women the vote." Now, I said to this young man, I loved that young man. I thought he was fantastic. Because he's a total victory for the struggle for justice, right? Because that young man could not understand why women didn't have a vote. It was incomprehensible. And he didn't understand why it was hard. Fantastic. I want everybody to be that way. I want my 10-year-old daughter to believe, to be, it's unimaginable for her to think that this couldn't happen. So, unfortunately, the young man was wrong. Women suffered and struggled, starved themselves to death, chained themselves to the White House, were beaten, were jailed, were force-fed to force the issue of voting rights for women onto the agenda. And in 1920, they got the right to vote. Do you realize that when they got the right to vote, if you read back in the headlines from that time, it's incredible. They're like, "Oh, that's the end of it. America's finished. It's all over. Women are voting." And you know what we found was women are surprisingly similar to men. Unfortunately. But not so similar, because this is the thing we never talk about when we talk about expanding the franchise, when we talk about bringing people into that room. Not pushing them out, bringing them in. If women had not gotten the right to vote, Mitt Romney would be the president of the United States today. Yeah. It's bottom line reality. If African Americans had not gotten the vote, Paul Ryan would be the vice president of the United States today. That's reality of giving people the right to vote. Things happen when people get the right to vote. And you know what happened when women got the right to vote? A lot of other people started to say, ho. What? You mean you can just change laws and constitutional amendments and give people the right to vote? And you know who? Native Americans. They said, you know what? This was our country before you took it from us. And we would like the right to vote. And the right to vote was extended to Native Americans, not at the founding of the American experiment, but deep into the 20th century. Latinos in the Southwest, Latinos often denied the franchise in many of the same structures, many of the same vehicles by which African Americans were denied in the Deep South, segregation, limits on the franchise. Latinos began to organize for the right to vote. Asian Americans on the West Coast and in regions, particularly in farming valleys, finally coming out to vote, coming to participate in the process, breaking down barriers, incredible organizing, incredible political activism to become a part of the American experiment. And here's the interesting thing. It didn't end some long time ago. In the 1960s, we talk about the Civil Rights Movement, and we understand the Civil Rights Movement as an epic American redemptive moment, right? Civil rights was redemptive. It was good for everybody because suddenly we were saying, you know what, we can fix things. And we don't even have to have a war, another war, to address these issues. But here's the interesting thing. John Kennedy, you don't get taught this enough in history. Why did John Kennedy go to Texas in 1963, in November of 1963? The start of November in 1963, the state of Texas voted on whether to get rid of the poll tax. It viciously divided the Democratic Party. The poll tax is a wealth tax. Remember when you guys were supposed to stand up and we got down to that guy? Well, all you folks who sat down, you white guys who sat down, you were poll tax victims, historically. You were barriers. Your barrier was a wealth tax. It was a saying, well, you can't vote because you can't pay the fee to vote. It would be like it's some crazy thing like making you pay for a driver's license or an ID to get a voter ID so you can vote. That would never happen. But you see, it was sort of like that once upon a time. And Kennedy went down there to try and reunite the Democratic Party that had been so divided over the issue of the poll tax. That's a big part of what he was talking to people. Kennedy, if you read the papers, Kennedy's papers, you will find that some of the last phone calls he made, busy, busy man, was in favor of a constitutional amendment to overturn the poll tax. Remember, we had a constitutional amendment to give African Americans the right to vote? African American men. We had a constitutional amendment to give women the right to vote. 1963, 1964, that was when we were fighting to remove the wealth barrier to voting. Not 1863, not 1763, 1963, John Kennedy was calling legislators saying, I need your support. Local legislators across this country, because we're going to try and get rid of the wealth barrier to voting in the United States. He did not live to see the constitutional amendment that got rid of the wealth barrier. It was finally approved in 1964. That's when we said to you folks I made sit down, so you can't be barred based on your income. You can't be barred based on your ability to pay to vote. And you know what happened then? Really interesting thing happened. Young people said, you know what? All these people are getting voting rights. We're even knocking down the segregation system in the South American apartheid. We're saying with a Civil Rights Act and a Voting Rights Act, you can vote in the South. We're doing all this stuff. Maybe we should be able to vote before you send us off to fight in a war in Vietnam. And in the late 1960s, early 1970s, voting rights were extended to 18 to 21-year-olds. You think, well, that didn't matter much, right? Couldn't matter much. Here's a little subtlety. In 2012, Barack Obama was reelected president of the United States by 5 million votes nationally. He had a 5 million vote margin. Amazingly enough, Haley Barbour said it was almost a tie. But the truth is, a 5 million vote margin. His margin, his advantage among people, younger voters, that class of younger voters, was roughly 5 million votes. Interesting subtlety here. That it matters every time we let somebody in the room. It matters every time we extend our democracy. And something happened right around the time young people got to vote. Things were opening up. This country was changing. Do you know how much this country was changing? Richard Milhouse Nixon was a liberal. No, I know, he's a hack. He's a, you know, there's so many reasons not to like Richard Nixon, right? I understand. But Richard Nixon signed the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, and he approved the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. And Richard Nixon broke down the barriers to China and to the Soviet Union. So we got to get beyond this Cold War thing. And Richard Nixon said we got to have a massive expansion of public housing. And Richard Nixon said we got to get rid of some of these unfair taxes on poor people so that they can actually live on the income, some of the income they're making. Richard Nixon was the guy who started talking about having Social Security indexed to inflation so that old folks could get a little more, you know, when prices went up. Richard Nixon was a liberal. Or, for a brief shining moment, America was a democracy. And Richard Nixon looked around and said, I can't win elections unless I do liberal things. When you open the doors and let people in the room, you change the dynamic of our politics. But as that dynamic changed, some people were very uncomfortable. Because it used to be really easy for that guy. Right? I know. For people like that guy. And it used to be really easy. They could get together in a small group and decide everything, right? They could decide the issues. They could decide the patterns of our politics. And some of the people who were getting a little bit upset with how crowded the room was becoming decided that it might be possible to make the room mean less, to make it matter less that we had opened those doors and let people in.
You've been listening to Speaker John Nichols here on today's forum on 90.1 FM KKFI. We have to take a quick break, but when we return, the remainder of his presentation. Stay tuned.
This is John Nichols from The Nation Magazine and from Free Press, America's Media Reform Network, saying that when I'm in Kansas and Missouri, the only media outlet I trust is 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, broadcasting across the Kansas City area and all the way to Lawrence. Keep it up.
After the Harvest needs volunteers to pick fresh vegetables and fruit in the greater KC area now. All ages are welcome. Please call 816-853-4460 or go to our Facebook page at After the Harvest KC for more information. This message, a public service of 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
A flighty jazz trumpet player settles down with a starry-eyed admirer. But can they weather the changes on the horizon?
Do you think he'll make it?
Honey, he's made it. This is it.
Sideman by Warren Light, starring Christine Lottie, Frank Wood, and Garrett Dillahunt. Next time on LA Theatre Works.
Wednesday evening from 7 to 9, right before chamber music.
A lot of people haven't decided how to vote in the August 5th election, which asked voters in Kansas City, Missouri to approve new taxes for streetcars and roads. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll give you both sides of the issue on the transportation sales tax and the streetcar referendum so you can decide. That's Heartland Labor Forum, Thursday, 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m. Black Oak, Arkansas, live in the KKFI studios on the Thursday night special at 7 p.m. Go, Jim Dandy, go!
You're tuned into the forum here on KKFI. Here's more from Speaker John Nichols.
There's a guy named Lewis Powell. Lewis Powell was a lawyer down in Virginia. Now, he was considered to be a moderate. He had not, you know, in the racial struggles of the 50s and the 60s, he had not been a bad guy. Hadn't necessarily been a good guy, but he hadn't been a bad guy. And Lewis Powell was a lawyer for a lot of big corporations, a lot of big business interests. In the late 1960s, very interesting thing happened. Maybe some of you are old enough to remember this. I know there's young people in the room. You will not remember this. We used to have tobacco ads on television. Yeah. There was a Johnny Carson show. There's a Johnny Carson show where at 11:59, the last tobacco ad went on air. Some Marlboro man saying, smoke a cigarette, it'll be good for you. And so they took tobacco ads off TV. And this lawyer from Virginia, which was a big tobacco state, Lewis Powell, he wrote a letter. It was actually a memorandum. And he said, you know what? I'm paraphrasing just a tiny bit here. says, you know what? If they can tell tobacco companies not to put ads on TV, the next thing they're going to do is tell us to clean up their water. And once they get done with that, they're going to tell us to clean up their air. And then it could happen. They're going to start telling us that you should not just have a minimum wage. Maybe you should have a living wage. And that corporations ought to not run everything. Maybe people ought to run things. And this could be a very problematic situation for some of us who have had the good side of the equation. And Lewis Powell's memo became so popular, it circulated through all of the major corporations. They're literally, if you go back, a friend of mine, Jeff Clement, who wrote a wonderful book on this, and we write about it in our book too, which, by the way, is a fine holiday gift. But Jeff Clement, he went down, he read Lewis Powell's papers, and there were all these incredible, they were like sort of like the kind of letter you would write to the person in high school that you really liked. You know, it's sort of like, could I possibly get a copy of that memo? Literally, these are CEOs of major corporations saying, can you send that to me? Because they were so interested. Because you know what Lewis Powell did in that memo? He said, corporations, money people, powerful people, rich people, we got to get more engaged with politics. Because they've let so many people in the room, and all those people are voting. We're having high turnout elections. Even when we elect Republicans, they create things like the Environmental Protection Agency. The whole thing is falling apart. And so he said, you know what we have to do? We have to define the debate. So this is what we have to do. We have to start think tanks. They don't really have to think. They just have to kind of push our ideas. And we have to start organizations that will spread legislative agendas down into the states, like the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. No, I'm not kidding. It's founded right in this period here. Heritage Foundation founded in the same period there. He kept writing about all these things you got to create to have a structural power that makes democracy less meaningful. That if you got a lot of people in the room, it doesn't matter that much because the power is now coming from outside the room. The power is defining things from outside rather than inside. And you know what he said? This is a very interesting thing. Lewis Powell said, you know, we might even have to create our own media. Unimaginably enough, he said, maybe we'd have to have syndicated right-wing radio talk shows that made working-class people think that it was in their interest to vote against their interests and in favor of our interests. We might even have to create a 24/7 TV network owned by some Australian that told people what to think about stuff. He didn't say the Australian part. Powell had this whole, almost everything that exists today as regards right-wing infrastructure was described by Powell. And the big thing he said was, you know what, we got to move our lobbying operations to Washington. Do you know in the early 1970s, you could actually go in Washington, tee up your golf ball, hit it as hard as you wanted, and you might not hit a lobbyist. Today, of course, that is impossible. But they moved lobbying operations from New York and Kansas City and Detroit to Washington to be near power. Because before that, corporations did not understand that they could actually define their profits by lobbying. They thought they actually had to create products and build things in America. And, you know, I realize some of the younger folks, yes, we used to make stuff here. And so they did that. And then he said one final thing, one final kind of interesting thing. We probably are going to have to spend a lot more money on elections. Like, we got to start putting real money into elections. And so this was what Lewis Powell proposed. Memo, very popular, circulated all over. And that would have been the end of it, right? Create Heritage Foundation, you know, create Fox, do some other stuff like that. But you know, what does that matter? Except for one interesting thing. I love the phones here. This is a very lively spot. One interesting thing. Richard Nixon had twice asked Lewis Powell if he would like to serve on the United States Supreme Court. And Lewis Powell had said, of course, the logical thing for a successful corporate lawyer, no. What kind of schmuck do you think I am? I'm making real money. I don't want to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. That's for, like, you know, I don't know, airy fairy. No. Nixon said, we could really use you on the court. And Lewis Powell accepted the nomination to serve on the United States Supreme Court within months after he wrote his memo. And when he went before the United States Senate, because he hadn't been that bad a guy on some other issues, the United States Senate approved him overwhelmingly. Only one person in the U.S. Senate voted against Lewis Powell. Fred Harris, the dirt on his boots senator from rural Oklahoma. That Oklahoma used to send liberal Democrats to the Senate. Back in the days when elections were decided not by dollars, but by votes. And Fred Harris said, you know, when I look at Lewis Powell, I don't think he's going to be all that good for the working man. Turned out Fred was onto something. Because when Lewis Powell got on the United States Supreme Court, do you know what he started doing? When they would get issues of campaign finance reform, like the Buckley v. Vallejo case. This is the case that would decide whether rich people could buy offices. You know, literally spend as much as you want on an election. A rich person spend as much as you want. Buckley v. Vallejo. You know, Lewis Powell would say, hey, you know, guys, if you want, I can do some of the research on this. I can help prepare the decisions here. When they got the Bilotti decision that allowed the big banks to go in and big corporations to spend money on referendums and initiatives, Lewis Powell's like, hey, don't worry, I can write this one. I can do it. And Powell kept pushing himself deeper and deeper into the decision-making about campaign finance reform. Now, the truth of the matter is, on a bunch of other issues, Powell wasn't that bad. When he died, his obituary said, this is, you know, a pretty moderate judge. But if you step back and you look at the pattern of decisions he was involved in as regards money and politics, decision after decision after decision saying you need to get rid of the barriers to money in politics. You need to let corporations and wealthy people participate at the highest level they want in our politics. Now, he had an opponent on the court. Not everybody went along with him. I know you're sitting there. You think it's everybody went along. No. No. There was this radical, left-winger, far-out, crazy guy. Can you guess? What'd you say? Douglas, that's good. No, wrong. Keep guessing. Yeah, wrong. Anybody got a notion? You know, who said it? She's right, but she's got her blue Move to a Men shirt on, so it doesn't count because they read ahead. But she is exactly right. William Rehnquist, one of the most conservative members of the Supreme Court, but Rehnquist kept saying, hold it. If you keep taking down the barriers to money in politics, we're going to end up with a situation where elections are decided by rich people, and where our agenda is defined by the rich and not by the whole of the electorate, we won't have democracy anymore. This won't be a functional democratic republic in any sense. And Rehnquist objected. And Powell left the court, but so did Rehnquist. And we got new judges. And you know who we got as our Chief Justice to replace Rehnquist? John Roberts. And the funny thing is, John Roberts wasn't a Rehnquist man. Yeah, because we cover our politics so horribly. Our media does such a lousy job of covering politics. We think that the only issue with the Supreme Court, or maybe only a couple of issues, maybe some social issues, and they matter. They matter fundamentally. But we don't look at some of these structural issues as regards how we organize our democracy. When you look at the structural issues as regards how we organize our democracy, John Roberts was a radical deviation from William Rehnquist. John Roberts was a Powell man. And John Roberts, in the United States Supreme Court, When issues of money and politics came forward, John Roberts said, now we're going to do that Powell agenda. And so when the Citizens United case came before the Supreme Court, what did John Roberts say? Now, remember, that was a small case. It was a minor case. But John Roberts said, no, I want you to re-argue this case. I want you to bring more issues. I want you to ask for more. Do you understand what that's like? Do you understand how that works? That would be if this guy crashed into your car, and you guys have worked out a settlement. He's going to give you a little bit of money for crashing into your car. And then this guy says, no, you should ask for his house. That's what Roberts did. He said to this guy's sitting up here saying, you don't have to give a house. But Roberts said, I want you to ask for a whole bunch more. And so the Citizens United folks came in, asked for a whole bunch more, and Roberts gave it to him. And then, once they had done that, saying corporations can essentially spend whatever they want to influence our elections, then they came back. We don't cover the court very well. They came back and did the Knox decision. Amazingly enough, they said it's going to be dramatically easier for corporations to spend money in politics. Then they did the Knox decision that said unions that want to put money into referendum votes, right, they have to poll every member. Now, you understand the difference of that. Corporation, you want to spend money? Great. Go ahead and do it. You don't have to ask every stockholder. You don't have to ask every consumer. You just go spend the money. Union, emergency situation, a vote on whether you're going to continue to function as a union, you got to poll your members. You understand? Structurally making it harder for popular organizations to engage, making it dramatically easier for corporations. And then they get the McCutcheon decision. Because amazingly enough, in this era, when Sheldon Adelson spent the better part of 200 $1 million in the 2012 election. When the Koch brothers, we still have not added up all that the Koch brothers have spent. The Supreme Court said it's too hard for rich people to influence our politics. And so they did the McCutcheon decision that said, get rid of a lot of those barriers. Now you can just spend pretty much whatever you want. Now, admittedly, there may be some barrier, you know, but when they talk about barriers at the top of, you know, what you can spend on politics now, it is so astronomically more than the ordinary American can even imagine that the money flows in at levels that are beyond comprehension. The 2012 election, we write about it in the book. First election in the history of the world that cost $10 billion. $10 billion. People say, well, you know, it worked out okay because Obama beat Romney. Grassroots beat money. No. Obama raised $100 million less than Romney, but it was a difference between $1.3 billion and $1.2 billion. Money competed with money. That was the reality of 2012. That will be the reality of 2014. That is the reality of the world we live in. And so I come before you today to say a simple thing. They've made the room meaningless. They've taken the meaning out of the room. We're all in now. Now, they do a voter ID thing here. They change the rules for voter participation there. But by and large, we can get into that room. They've still got these terrible barriers on people who have, you know, committed a crime long ago, served their debt to society, but still aren't allowed to vote. There are barriers. But by and large, we're in the room. But what they have now done is a situation where they have made the people in the room the spectators. We watch as they define the issues. They flood our television with ads. What's the point of a television ad? Is it to influence somebody to vote? No. Television ads are overwhelmingly negative. They go on air to influence people not to vote. If you imagine this, I'm looking at these two women here, right? You're saying, I'm going to vote for this pro-choice candidate because I believe that a woman's right to, I'm not making any assumptions about you, but that a woman's right to choose matters, and I'm going to vote for this pro-choice candidate. And then they put out an ad that says the pro-choice candidate you were going to vote for is the worst person in the world. And you decide, okay, they're all awful, I'm not going to vote. You don't switch over to the anti-choice candidate. You don't cross the line politically. You stand down. And so what do we have in America? What we have in America is dramatically lower turnout than we historically had. This is a big deal. India just had elections. India had a better part of 20% higher turnout than the United States is. I've covered elections in India. It's hard to vote in India. And the fact of the matter is, we have actually squeezed people out of our democratic process, not by locking them out of the room, but by flooding them with messages so negative that they decide not to participate. We have dumbed down our media to such an extent that our media now covers the ads. No, think about this. In an election season, our media covers the ads. They say, well, this guy just put up an ad. Or they cover the wealth raise. How much have you raised? You're not a credible candidate, Dennis Kucinich, because you didn't raise as much money as the other candidates. You're not a credible candidate for President of the United States, Bernie Sanders, because you're not going to be able to raise the kind of money that other people raise. We begin to push people out of the process because they don't have money. And our media itself feeds into that. So we have this crisis situation where our politics is so defined by money, so narrowed in its range of options, that it is a democratic meltdown. To think of it differently is absurd. If you just put your head up above and look around, you realize the absurdity of the thing. $10 billion on an election, negative ads flooding our airwaves, our media not covering our politics in any kind of meaningful way. Brothers and sisters, we just got to fix it. I'm sorry. I really apologize for coming to this library in Kansas City and saying that you have work ahead of you, but you have work ahead of you. The fact of the matter is, we're going to have to amend the Constitution of the United States to say money is not speech, corporations are not people, and we have a right to organize elections where the dollar matters less than the vote. We got to do it. We have to do it. We have to do it. And let me just close by saying a very simple thing about this. I know that up to that point you were enjoying this address. You were saying, well, this is a pleasure to be with you. Mr. Nichols, you seem reasonable, nice stories. But you've just asked us to amend the Constitution, and it is impossible to amend the Constitution of the United States. It cannot be done. The Constitution was written in stone, handed down to Michelle Bachmann. So you cannot change the Constitution. It's never happened before, except maybe 10 times in the first 4 years of the American experiment. Constitution's never been amended beyond that, though, just the Bill of Rights. That was it, except for, 17, 18 more times, including one time when the Vice President of the United States shot the Secretary of the Treasury and we decided new ways to elect vice presidents were needed. We've amended the Constitution again and again and again, and largely we have amended it to expand and make functional our democracy. It is not an unreasonable thing to say that we must amend it once more. And there are people here tonight who are pushing for that. I know how hard it is to imagine yourself working to amend the Constitution of the United States. I know that many people are resistant to that. But I want you to just understand that 100 years ago, in this country, if a little girl ran down the front steps of the place where she lived, she wasn't going to school. She was going to work. And that little girl often would work in a mill. She might have been a bobbin girl. A bobbin girl is somebody that reached into the machine, changed the bobbins. Unfortunately, in those days, they didn't always turn the machines off. So sometimes the little girl would lose a finger or a hand. They would send her home, injured for life, and no one was punished because it was a gilded age. And in a gilded age, the person who owned the factory got to decide what happened to the people who worked in the factory. They didn't have the power to shift that. And if that little girl grew up, she might get a job in a textile mill. Maybe it's sewing clothes. In a big city, she might work on the 10th or 11th floor of a building. And on that 10th or 11th floor of the building, she was surrounded by young girls, immigrants, Italians and Jews and Irish and Germans, all speaking different languages, African Americans who'd come up from the South to get away from segregation, this incredible mix of young women all working together, making these clothes strong, vibrant, with great hopes. And when that room caught on fire, the women had to decide not how to run down the steps. The doors were nailed shut because they didn't let women take a bathroom break, and they didn't want to steal a bathroom break. They had to decide whether to burn alive or to jump to their death. And when the mothers and the fathers and the sisters and the brothers and the aunts and the uncles of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire victims came to gather the dead on the streets of New York, they decided not to have closed funerals, but to have open funerals. They invited people to see what a gilded age had done. And one of the things they said was these women did not have the right to vote on their own condition. And if they did have the right to vote, they didn't have the right to elect a U.S. Senate because the Senate was appointed, not elected. And they didn't have the right to tax or regulate major corporations because we did not have those structures in place. That was a little over 100 years ago. In a 10-year period, we amended the Constitution of the United States to give women the right to vote. We amended the Constitution of the United States to create an elected United States Senate. We amended the Constitution of the United States to create a tax and regulatory system that would form the underpinnings of the New Deal. We did that in a 10-year period. So I come to Kansas City tonight to ask a simple question. Are you the equal of your grandparents and your great-grandparents? Are you the equal of those people who looked at those bodies in the streets of New York and said, no more? Are you the oligarchy response team of our era? And are you ready to say, if they have made our democracy dysfunctional, then we will make a constitution that renews our democracy and that brings people back into this process. No more a Supreme Court that tells us the vote doesn't matter as much as the dollar. We will create a democracy where the vote is supreme, where corporations do not have the power to tell us what to do, where we have the power to tell corporations what to do, and where the Gilded Age is no more. Brothers and sisters, it's time to amend. Thank you very much.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you very much. Did you really tell me that you didn't think you'd be able to go for more than 35
minutes?
Yeah,
no, it's funny.
I mean, you wouldn't have enough material to go for more than half an hour?
I have to tell you, I was inspired by the crowd.
Of course.
Often I'm in a place as inspiring as Kansas City, Missouri.
Well, we will allow the glorious Kansas City Public Library audience to inspire you a bit more with about maybe 10 minutes of questions.
Absolutely.
We have 10 minutes for questions.
All right.
Three sentences or less, and you're first.
And quick answers, too.
I've had the pleasure of meeting your publisher and editor, Katrina Vandenhoevel. I know her family. In fact, I play polo with her cousins. The reason I mention that is that Katrina is the beneficiary of a $300 million inheritance from her grandfather, which allowed her to buy the nation and publish it. Why is the concentration of wealth abhorrent when it's the Kochs or Sheldon Adelson, but acceptable when it's George Soros or Katrina Vandenhoof?
Terrific question. Let me answer it. I'm not interested in the concentration of wealth. I have problems with it on another level. But we're talking tonight about democracy. We're talking about people with concentrated wealth having a freeway into defining our democracy. That's what I have a problem with. I believe that in this country, it's very, very common for people to build on their talents, make wealth, to inherit wealth sometimes. All these things happen. But what I don't believe, what I absolutely do not believe, as somebody born and raised in rural small-town Wisconsin, in a place where our democracy was defined by knocking on doors and by ideas and by values, not by money, I don't believe that my daughter should grow up in a country where a rich man can buy a U.S. Senate seat, be he a liberal or a conservative, and I don't believe that our Congress should be arguing about whether to cut food stamps for little children and then finding all the money they need for useless and pointless wars around the world, and that wars that we fight are a money and politics issue, not a function. So my problem is not with concentrated wealth. My problem is not with concentrated wealth, although I may have a problem on another. We want to have another discussion. I can have that. But my core problem as regards our democracy is that we don't create an equal situation for an equal discourse in this country.
Thank you.
I love you for asking that question, by the way. Ladies and gentlemen, somebody who asks a question that presses you is a hero in any room. Let's give him a round of applause.
First of all, Mr. Nichols, I want to thank you for your fantastic endorsement of Move to Amend earlier today.
Well, I endorse those who try to fix the thing, yes.
Okay, yeah, well, and seeing that as a vehicle for fixing it. Can you see any better way for people in the Kansas City Metro to really get involved with fixing the problem than to do something like stand up and get active with Move to Amend? And I will say there are Move to Amend folks outside right now.
Begging for signatures.
Well, what we really want are volunteers. We are all volunteers, and what we want and need are more and more and more. And so.
You're wonderful. Let me take that question, and let me then take this gentleman as well so we can close ourselves off tonight, and I'll answer, but I'll put it all together in some sort of way.
Yeah, you had mentioned in your presentation the group ALEC.
Yeah.
They had a get-together here in Kansas City recently.
I know they did, yes.
And there was one party that had a poster that says, please donate so that I can buy me a representative.
I love you for standing in line to give us that contribution. Now a guy who wasn't in line and butted in this year, so we're not going to give him any respect. But let me just close off by saying, look, the fact of the matter is that the most powerful tool that money has in any process is the suggestion that it will always win. That's much more powerful than anything else. And so our Move to Amend friend just got up here and talked about buying a representative. All these folks. The truth of the matter is, we have immense power within us. We have immense power within us to fix this thing. We have fixed this thing again and again and again. The only thing that will destroy America is if you people in this room tonight decide that it's too much for you to do. Because the fact of the matter is, every generation has fixed the thing from Tom Paine on, and now we're putting the responsibility in your hand. And the great anthropologist Claude Levi Strauss said he hated it when somebody asked when was the Golden Age or what are the parameters of the Golden Age. He had studied all the great civilizations of history. He said, I hated it when somebody asked when was the Golden Age, because that suggested that this is not the Golden Age. And what Claude Levi Strauss said, we have to stop thinking that way and to start thinking the Golden Age is in us. We can live in the greatest time in history. It only requires us to engage. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, John.
You've been listening to Speaker John Nichols on today's forum. He's a spokesperson for Nation Magazine and the co-founder of Free Press. He spoke earlier this year on May 22nd at Kansas City Public Library. Now stay tuned for more great programming here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.